Truck Audio Tales.
Brought to you by BunnySlippers.com. Check out their brand new Dino Sound Slippers. Slippers make a roaring sound every 3 steps. Made with green scaly fabric, soft plush uppers, foam footbeds, non-slip grips on soles, and 3 white claws on each foot. One size fits most, up to women's 10.5, men's 9. Footbed measures 10.5. Black Clock Audio Tales is a daily podcast that reads you a story, either a chapter of a novel or a whole short story. Join us in our exploration of old ghost stories, supernatural fiction, horror tales, folk tales, fantasy, gothic horror, weird fiction, and cosmic horror. And don't forget to join us for our monthly show about the Cthulhu mythos. Look for our podcast near the old wishing well in the blasted heath, wherever you find your podcasts. We suggest Podbean or Apple Podcasts. Find us on the web at pgttcm.com and at Black Clock Audio on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook, and Black Clock Audio Tales on YouTube. Welcome to Black Clock Audio Tales. Check out our new website over at www.pgttcm.com. Edited by Daniel Spitzer, music by Kevin MacLeod. The Chamber, Oppressive Gloom, Despair. Welcome to Part 1, Folklore of Great Britain.
Join us at the end of the month when we talk about the Great Old Ones.
Welsh Fairy Tales by William Elliot Griffiths. Chapter 8, The Touch of Clay. Long, long ago, before the Cymry came into the beautiful land of Wales, there were dark-skinned people living in caves. In these early times, there were a great many fairies of all sorts, but of very different kinds of behaviour, good and bad. It was in this age of the world that fairies got an idea riveted into their heads which nothing, not even hammers, chisels, or crowbars can pry up. Neither horsepower, nor hydraulic force, nor 16-inch bombs, nor cannonballs, nor torpedoes can drive it out. It is a settled matter of opinion in fairyland that, compared with fairies, human beings are very stupid. The fairies think that mortals are dull-witted and awfully slow when compared to the smarter and more nimble fairies that are always up-to-date in doing things. Perhaps the following story will help explain why this is. The ancient folks who lived in caves could not possibly know some things that are like ABC to the fairies of today. For the Welsh fairies, King Puck and Queen Mab know all about what is in the telegraphs, submarine cables, and wireless telegraphy of today. Puck would laugh if you should say that a telephone was anything new to him. Long ago, in Shakespeare's time, he boasted that he could put a girdle round the earth in 40 minutes. Men have been trying ever since to catch up with him, but they have not gone ahead of him yet. If, only 300 years ago, this were the case, what must have been Puck's fun when he saw men in the early days working so hard to make even a clay cup or saucer? These people who slept and ate in cave boarding houses knew nothing of metals, or how to make iron or brass tools, wire or machines, or how to touch a button and light up a whole room, which even a baby can now do. There is one thing that we, who have travelled in many fairy lands, have often noticed and told our friends, the little folks, and that is this. All the fairies we ever knew are very slow to change either their opinions, or their ways, or their fashions. Like many mortals, they think a great deal of their own notions. They imagine that the only way to do a thing is in that which they say is the right one. So it came to pass that even when the Cymric folk gave up wearing the skins of animals, and put on pretty clothes woven on a loom, and ate out of dishes instead of clam shells, there were still some fairies that kept the notions and fashions of the cave days. To one of these came trouble because of this failing. Now there was once a pretty nymph who lived in the Red Lake, to which a young and handsome farmer used to come to catch fish. One misty day, when the lad could see only a few feet before him, a wind cleared the air and blew away the fog. Then he saw near him a little old man standing on a ladder. He was hard at work in putting a thatched roof on a hut which he had built. A few minutes later, as the mist rose and the breezes blew, The farmer could see no house, but only the ripplings of water on the lake's surface. Although he went fishing often, he never again saw anything unusual during the whole summer. On one hot day in the early autumn, while he stopped to let his horse drink, he looked and saw a very lovely face on the water. Wondering to whom it might belong, there rose up before him the head and shoulders of a most beautiful woman. She was so pretty that he had two tumbles. He fell off his horse and he fell in love with her at one and the same time. Rushing toward the lovely vision, he put out his arms at that spot where he had seen her, but only to embrace empty air. Then he remembered that love is blind, so he rubbed his eyes to see if he could discern anything. Yet though he peered down into the water and up over the hills, he could not see her anywhere. But he soon found out to his joy that his eyes were all right, for in another place the face, flower-crowned hair, and her reflection in the water came again. Then his desire to possess the damsel was doubled, but again she disappeared to rise again somewhere else. Five times he was thus tantalized and disappointed. She rose up and quickly disappeared. It seemed as though she meant only to tease him, so he rode home sorrowing and scarcely slept that night. Early morning found the lovelorn youth again at the lakeside, but for hours he watched in vain. He had left his home too excited to have eaten his usual breakfast, which greatly surprised his housekeeper. Now he pulled out some sweet apples, which a neighbour had given him, and began to munch them, while still keeping watch on the waters. No sooner had the aroma of the apples fallen on the air than the pretty lady of the lake bobbed up from beneath the surface, and this time quite near him. She seemed to have lost all fear, for she asked him to throw her one of the apples. "Please come, pretty maid, and get it yourself," cried the farmer. And he held up the red apple, turning it round and round before her, to tempt her by showing its glossy surface and rich colour. Apparently not afraid, she came up close to him and took the apple from his left hand. At once he slipped his strong right arm around her waist and hugged her tight. At this she screamed loudly. Then there appeared in the middle of the lake the old man he had seen thatching the roof by the lake shore. This time, besides his long snowy beard, he had on his head a crown of water lilies. "Mortal," said the venerable person, "that is my daughter you are clasping. What do you wish to do with her?" At once the farmer broke out in passionate appeal to the old man that she might become his wife. He promised to love her always, treat her well, and never be rough or cruel to her. The old father listened attentively. He was finally convinced that the farmer would make a good husband for his lovely daughter, yet he was very sorry to lose her, and he solemnly laid one condition upon his future son-in-law. He was never under any pretense, or in any way, to strike her with clay or with anything made or baked from clay. Any blow with that from which men made pots and pans and jars and dishes, or in fact with earth of any sort, would mean the instant loss of his wife. Even if children were born in their home, the mother would leave them and return to fairyland under the lake, and be forever subject to the law of the fairies, as before her marriage. The farmer was very much in love with his pretty prize, and as promises are easily made, he took oath that no clay should ever touch her. They were married and lived very happily together. Years passed, and the man was still a good husband and lover. He kept up the habit which he had learned from a sailor friend. Every night, when far from home and out on the sea, he and his mates would drink this toast: "Sweethearts and wives, may every sweetheart become a wife, and every wife remain a sweetheart, and every husband continue a lover." So he proved that though a husband he was still a lover, by always doing what she asked him and more. When the children were born and grew up, their father told them about their mother's likes and dislikes, her tastes and wishes, and warned them always to be careful. So it was altogether a very happy family. One day the wife and mother said to her husband that she had a great longing for apples. She would like to taste some like those which he long ago gave her. At once the good man dropped what he was doing and hurried off to his neighbour, who had first presented him with a tray full of these apples. The farmer not only got the fruit, but he also determined that he would plant a tree and thus have apples for his wife whenever she wanted them. so he bought a fine young sapling to set in his orchard, for the children to play under and to keep his pantry full of the fine red-cheeked fruit. At this his wife was delighted. So happy enough, in fact too merry to think of anything else, they, both husband and wife, proceeded to set the sapling in the ground. She held the tree while he dug down to make the hole deep enough to make sure of its growing. But farmers are sometimes very superstitious. They even believe in luck, though not in puck. Some of them have faith in what the almanac and the patent medicine may say, and in planting potatoes according to the moon, but they scout the idea of there being any fairies. With the farmer, this had become a fixed state of mind, and now it brought him to grief, as we shall see. Although he remembered what his wife liked and disliked, and recalled what her father had told him, he had forgotten that she was a fairy. With this farmer and other Welsh mortals, it had become a habit, when planting a young tree, to throw the last shovelful of earth over the left shoulder. This was for good luck. The farmer was afraid to break such a good custom as he thought it to be. So merrily he went to work, forgetting everything in his adherence to habit. He became so absorbed in his job that he did not look where his spadeful went, and it struck his dear wife full in the breast. At that moment she cried out bitterly, not in pain, but in sorrow. Then she started to run towards the lake. At the shore she called out, "Goodbye, dear, dear husband." Then leaping into the water, she was never seen again, and all his tears and all those of the children never brought her back. Chapter 9. The Touch of Iron. Ages ago, before the Cymry rode in their coracles across the sea, there was a race of men already in the Land of Honey, as Great Britain was then called. These ancient people, who lived in caves, did not know how to build houses or to plough the ground. They had no idea that they could get their food out of the earth. As for making bread and pies, cookies and goodies, from what grew from the soil, they never heard of such a thing. They were not acquainted with the use of fire for melting copper, nor did they know how to get iron out of the ore, to make knives and spears, arrowheads and swords, and armour and helmets. All they could do was to mould clay, so as to make things to cook with and hold milk or water. When they baked this soft stuff in the fire, they found they had pots, pans and dishes as hard as stone, though these were easily broken. To hunt the deer, or to fight the wolves and bears, they fashioned clubs of wood. For javelins and arrows, they took hard stone like flint and chipped it to points and sharpened it with edges. This was the time which men now call the Stone Age. When the men went to war, their weapons were wholly of wood or stone. They had not yet learned to weave the wool of the sheep into warm clothing, but they wore the skins of animals. Each one of the caves in which they lived was a general boarding house for dogs and pigs, as well as people. When a young man of one tribe wanted a wife, he sallied out secretly into another neighbourhood. There he lay in wait for a girl to come along. He then ran away with her and back to his own daddy's cave. By and by, when the Cymry came into the land, they had iron tools and better weapons of war. Then there were many and long battles, and the Aborigines were beaten many times. So the cave people hated everything made of iron. Any one of the cave people, girls or boys, who had picked up iron ornaments and were found wearing or using iron tools, or buying anything of iron from the cave people's enemies, was looked upon as a rascal or a villain, or even as a traitor, and was driven out of the tribe. However, some of the daughters of the cavemen were so pretty, and had such rosy cheeks and lovely bodies and beautiful long hair, that quite often the Cymric youth fell in love with them. Many of the cavemen's daughters were captured and became wives of the Cymry and mothers of the children. In course of ages, their descendants helped to make the bright, witty, song-loving Welsh people. Now the fairies usually like things that are old, and they are very slow to alter the ancient customs to which they have been used. For, in the fairy world, there is no measure of time, nor any clocks, watches, or bells to strike the hours, and no almanacs or calendars. The fairies cannot understand why ladies change the fashions so often, and their men their ways of doing things. They wonder why beards are fashionable at one time, then moustaches, long or short, at another, or smooth faces when razors are cheap. Most fairies like to keep on doing the same thing in the old way. They enjoy being like the mountains, which stand, or the sea, that rolls, or the sun, that rises and sets every day and forever. They never get tired of repeating tomorrow what they did yesterday. They are very different from the people that are always wanting something else, and even cry if they cannot have it. That is the reason why the fairies did not like iron, or to see men wearing iron hats and clothes, called helmets and armour, when they went to war. They no more want to be touched by iron than by filth or foul disease. They hated knives, stirrups, scythes, swords, pots, pans, kettles, or this metal in any form, whether sheet, barbed wire, lump, or pig iron. Now there was a long, pretty stretch of water, near which lived a handsome lad, who loved nothing better than to go out on moonlight nights and see the fairies dance, or listen to their music. This youth fell in love with one of these fairies, whose beauty was great beyond description. At last, unable to control his passion, he rushed into the midst of the fairy company, seized the beautiful one, and rushed back to his home, with his prize in his arms. This was in true caveman fashion. When the other fairies hurried to rescue her, they found the man's house shut. They dared not touch the door, for it was covered over with iron studs and bands, and bolted with the metal which they most abhorred. The young man immediately began to make love to the fairy maid, hoping to win her to be his wife. For a long time she refused, and moped all day and night. While weeping many salt water tears, she declared that she was too homesick to live. Nevertheless, the lover persevered, finding herself locked in with iron bars, while gratings, bolts, and creaking hinges were all about her, and unable to return to her people. The fairy first thought out a plan of possible escape. Then she agreed to become the man's wife. She resolved, at least, that, without touching it, she should oil all the ironwork and stop the noise. She was a smart fairy, and was sure she could outwit the man, even if he were so strong and had every sort of iron everywhere in order to keep her, as it were, in a prison. So, pretending she loved him dearly, she said, "I will not be your wife, but, if you can find out my name, I shall gladly become your servant." "Easily won," thought the lover to himself. Yet the game was a harder one to play than he supposed. It was like playing blind man's buff, or hunt the slipper. Although he made guesses of every name he could think of, he was never hot, and got no nearer to the thing sought than if his eyes were bandaged. All the time he was deeper and deeper in love with the lovely fairy maid. But one night, on returning home, he saw in a turf bog a group of fairies sitting on a log. At once, he thought, they might be talking about their lost sister. So he crept up quite near them, and soon found that he had guessed right. After a long discussion, finding themselves still at a loss as to how to recover her, he heard one of them sigh and say, "Oh, Swissy, my sister, how can you live with a mortal?" "Enough," thought the man to himself, "I've got it." Then, crawling away noiselessly, he ran back all the way to his house and unlocked the door. Once inside the room, he called out his servant's name, "Swissy, Swissy." Astonished at hearing her name, she cried out, "What mortal has betrayed me? For surely no fairy would tell of me. Alas, my fate, my fate." But in her own mind, the struggle and the fear were over. She had bravely striven to keep her fairyhood, and in the battle of wits, had lost. She would not be wife, but what a wise, superb, and faithful servant she made! Everything prospered under her hand. The house and the farm became models. Not twice, but three times a day, the cows, milked by her, yielded milk unusually rich in cream. In the market her butter excelled, in quality and price, all others. Meanwhile the passion of the lover abated not one jot, or for an instant. His perseverance finally won, she agreed to become his wife, but only on one condition. "You must never strike me with iron," she said. "If you do, I'll feel free to leave you and go back to my relatives in the fairy family." A hearty laugh from the happy lover greeted this remark, made by the lovely creature, once his servant, but now his betrothed. He thought that the condition was very easy to obey. So they were married, and no couple in all the land seemed to be happier. Once, twice, the cradle was filled. It rocked with new treasures that had life, and were more dear than farm or home or wealth in barns or cattle, cheese and butter. A boy and a girl were theirs. Then the mother's care was unremitting day and night. Even though the happy father grew richer every year and bought farm after farm until he owned 5,000 acres, he valued more than these possessions his lovely wife and his beautiful children. Yet this very delight and affection made him less vigilant, yes, even less careful concerning the promise he had once given to his fairy wife, who still held the ancient ideas of the fairy family in regard to iron. One of his finest mares had given birth to a filly, which, when the day of the great fair came, he determined to sell at a high price. So with a halter on his arm, he went out to catch her. But she was a lively creature, so frisky that it was much like his first attempt to win his fairy bride. It almost looked as if she were a cave girl running away from a lover who had a lasso in his hand. The lively and frolicsome beast scampered here and there, grazing as she stopped, as if she were determined to put off her capture as long as possible. So calling to his wife, the two of them together tried their skill to catch the filly. This time, leaving the halter in the house, the man took bit and bridle, and the two managed to get the pretty creature into a corner. But when they had almost captured her, away she dashed again. By this time the man was so vexed that he lost his temper, and he who does that usually loses the game, while he who controls the wrath within wins. Mad as a flaming fire, he lost his brains also, and threw the bit and bridle and the whole harness after the fleet animal. Alas, alas, the wife had started to run after the filly, and the iron bit struck her on the cheek. It did not hurt, but he had broken his vow. Now came the surprise of his life. It was as if, at one moment, a flash of lightning had made all things bright, and then in another second was inky darkness. He saw this lovely wife, one moment active and fleet as a deer, in another, in the twinkling of an eye, nothing was there. She had vanished. After this, there was a lonely home, empty of its light and cheer. But by living with human beings, a new idea and form of life had transformed this fairy, and a new spell was laid on her. Mother love had been awakened in her heart. Henceforth, though the law of the fairy world would not allow her to touch again the realm of earth, she, having once been wife and parent, could not forget the babies born of her body. So, making a sod raft, a floating island, she came up at night and often, while these three mortals lived. This fairy mother would spend hours tenderly talking to her husband and her two children, who were now a big boy and girl, as they stood on the lake shore. On his part, the father did not think it an ideal arrangement, as some modern married folks do, to be thus separated, wife and husband, one from the other. But by her coming as near as could be allowed, she showed her undying love. Even today, good people sometimes see a little island floating on the lake, and this they point out as the place where the fairy mother was wont to come and hold converse with her dear ones, while they merrily eat the pink delicacy called floating island, moving it about with a spoon on its yellow lake of eggs and cream. They call this the fairy mother's rocking chair.